This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
No fluff, no guessing. When CFA Charterholder is on that resume, it means something real. Intensive study, tough exams, relentless drive, true grit, a strong network. Hiring managers get it instantly. The CFA Charter is more than letters after a name. It's proof of discipline, resilience, and integrity under pressure. It shows who you are before you even walk in the room. Explore what the Charterholder Advantage looks like at cfainstitute.org.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Halloween is almost upon us, so here's something to scare you. In the last few weeks, the CEO of America's largest bank, JP Morgan Chase, has warned of the possibility of a big fall in an overvalued US stock market and a shock to the financial system from a growing banking sector commonly known as shadow banking. And equally recently, the Bank of England has echoed these concerns. These are not sources to be treated lightly. So, are we heading for the crash of 25? What do the experts say? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. With me to explain where we've got to and where we might be heading are Katie Martin, markets columnist at the Financial Times, Duncan Weldon, economist and author of Blood and Treasure, and Simon French, chief economist and head of research at investment company Panmure Liberum. Simon, I'd like to start with you and what's actually happened to the US stock market in recent months. We hear it's rising rapidly. Can you give us some kind of idea of the scale?
The rebound in global stock markets led by the US stock market has added about $28 trillion to the value of global shares. Now, to put that number in context, that's almost the size of the US economic output each year. And that's a 31% increase in just 6 months since the global stock markets bottomed out after Liberation Day in the US.
That's Trump's tariff day.
That's correct. And that has only happened on three previous occasions in modern market history. 1987, 1999 and 2009. And it doesn't take huge knowledge of market history to realise those were three quite seismic years for stock market volatility. And that is one of the reasons why we've heard the concerns, the warnings from bank execs, both in investment banks and central banks in recent days.
So that's the straightforward scale of the increase. Are there any other kind of what you might call telltale metrics that can indicate whether we could be heading for some kind of crash?
So equity analysts, strategists will use a variety of measures to understand how expensive stock markets are. One of the most widely used is the Shiller price earnings ratio, which controls the fact that earnings sometimes in companies are volatile. And that measure is hovering around 40 times earnings in the US stock market. Now, it's only been there once before in modern market history, and that was at the height of the dot-com bubble in 99, early 2000. And that, again, is a data point from valuations that indicate that the enthusiasm that has been driven by some of the, if you like, economic first principles of AI potentially adding to productivity, adding to the earnings capacity, potentially driving earnings, if those aren't realised, those valuations look pretty frothy.
Well, since you've now mentioned those two letters, how much of this growth in the stock market is down to AI, can be attributed to it?
So if you look of that $28 trillion, about $13 trillion, so almost half of it, are US tech, which has a line of sight to AI. Unfortunately, we don't put tech stocks in a neat bucket of what is AI and what is not AI. And again, echoes from history. And those of us around the table who remember the dot-com bubble, companies put dot-com after their name to define themselves as internet companies. To some extent, you're getting that a lot in the moment in the stock market of .AI or we are AI enabled. Are they true AI companies? It's very difficult to decipher. So if you just take the sector classification of technology, it's about half that addition of market capitalization.
Market capitalization would mean the gains, essentially.
Correct. About 13.
So nearly half of all the gains are just in this tech sector.
Yeah.
I think we're going to kind of dig down a little bit into a bit more in a moment into what that actually means. But Katie, what are the professional investors telling you? I mean, is it us just, you know, us journalists getting nervous, or are they getting a bit antsy too?
I mean, to a certain extent, yes, it is, you know, journalists being misery guts, which is what we do best, and talking about things that can go wrong rather than things that can go right. You know, that's what journalism is to a large extent when it comes to talking about risks in markets. But when I speak to professional investors, which I do pretty much every day, they all say to me, they just hate what they see. They think tech stocks are wildly overvalued. They think the Trump administration is trying to stage a hostile takeover of the Federal Reserve, right, the central bank in the States. They can see what's happening to the rule of law in the States. They can see what's happening to the White House. They can see yada, yada, yada. They don't like any of it. But they say, do you know what? As long as these companies are making money, and unlike in the dot-com boom, these tech companies are making shed loads of money, then they say, we have no choice really but to keep buying them. You've got to, you know, keep dancing while the music plays, and, you know, that hackneyed phrase. They can't see an immediate trigger for this all to turn around. They can't see a catalyst for it to fall apart. And that makes life very difficult for professional investors who do feel uncomfortable but have to keep doing it anyway.
Simon, who is actually doing the buying of these tech shares, and on the basis that they have a large AI component?
So what is quite interesting around the last 6 months and the rebound since the post-Liberation Day lows is the participation of retail investors, particularly US retail investors. And
what is a retail investor?
So not an institutional investor, not a pension fund or an insurance fund, but actually, to some extent, the individual who plays the stock market. And in the case of the US retail investor, participation in that way, which is already relatively high compared to, for example, the UK, grew quite sharply during the pandemic. Time on your hands, stimulus checks from the government. And when you break down, as the US Treasury does, the participation in the US stock market amongst the lowest income groups, actually you have far greater participation. It's grown almost fivefold since 2020.
Fivefold?
Fivefold in terms of their holdings. Now, from a low base, so percentages can be a little bit misleading in that regard, but what it tells you, and perhaps where I'm concerned putting my other hat on, which is as an economist, is the potential, if there is a crash, and of course it has to be an if, the blowback into the wider economy, if it impacts disproportionately on low-income households, potentially their consumption is quite, or their consumer spending is quite volatile to what goes on in the stock market, which we sometimes think is a sort of high-class, high-earnings problem. Potentially, it's manifesting itself in lower-income groups in the US.
Duncan, on that point precisely, at one level, you could say, well, the wisdom of crowds, you know, and when everybody kind of gets together, how can they all possibly be wrong? And then on the other hand, you think, this is a whole lot of people rushing to the front of the plane to fly it instead of the pilot, on the basis that they think they know where to go better than he or she does.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, your stereotypical US retail investor until recently is a dentist in Illinois. You know, earns a bit of money, reads Barron's and the Wall Street Journal and picks themselves a few stocks, far more than British people do. You know, as Simon was saying, sort of participation in the stock market really has grown over the last few years, particularly since the pandemic. I was in the States at an economics conference the week before last. What I was amazed by watching the television, every other advert was either for cryptocurrency, sports betting, or trading in stock market investment apps. It was sort of constantly being pushed, and it's clearly taken off in a much bigger way than previously.
Well, it used just to be incontinence pads, didn't it?
And, fewer drug adverts and more investing and gambling.
Yeah, well, I suppose my question is whether one should be worried about that.
I think there are reasons for worry if there are people participating in this rally who can't afford to take the losses. And when you see more lower income households putting more money into the stock market, that's your potential concern, your feedback mechanism from a stock market crash to sort of real impact on the real economy.
Right, okay. So we might have very happy retail investors, or we might have, as Katie suggested, people who do this professionally being rather more worried. Duncan, one other question. What about the AI companies, the tech companies themselves? Are they part of this investment situation?
I mean, one thing I found really striking over the last few weeks is all of the sort of, you know, big bits of the financial press, the Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, are all having to publish sort of increasingly complicated flowcharts of the financial linkages between these big AI firms. You've got three parts of the AI supply chain. You've got the companies actually making the models, like OpenAI making LLMs, that sort of thing, large language models. You've got the companies providing the compute, the data centers processing this. And then you've got the chip makers supplying the data centers.
Notably NVIDIA.
And what we've seen, particularly over the last couple of months, is more and more financial tie-ups with, NVIDIA investing a lot of money into OpenAI. And OpenAI is going to spend that money on compute, and the people providing that compute are going to buy chips from NVIDIA. So the whole sector is becoming much more sort of entwined than previously.
Are there precedents for that kind of level of entwining?
There are. I'd actually add a fourth group, if Duncan will permit me, which is the utility sector. I mean, this is a sector that is very energy hungry. Mm. Some of the biggest investment is actually going into what we remember perhaps from the dot-com period as the sort of picks and shovels enabling the internet. Well, actually, in the case of AI, it is power. It is nuclear power. It is solar. It is wind. It is gas. Big capital markets activity, actually a dual listing between the UK and the US Fermi, big energy production facility in Texas, designed solely to facilitate a lot of that at the data centers, which was, I think, Duncan's third bucket. But I mean, that interdependency that we've seen between different parts of sectors on the stock market is quite clear. And it talks to a broader piece, actually, about the investment landscape, is how synchronous, how in the jargon, pro-cyclical pricing is. When it all goes up, it starts to feed off itself. But of course, that same force can work in the opposite direction on the way down.
Okay, right. Katie, I think it now is going to be your duty to remind us what the dot-com bubble was, since we've now mentioned it two or three times.
There was a period of time where, you know, as Simon was suggesting, there was, you know, the internet was born. Hooray, we've got this bouncing baby internet. And there was a bunch of stocks that were connected with it. And there are some of them that have survived through to the end. You look at Amazon, for example. That's the kind of prime example of the company that sprang up in this era and has become this multi-trillion dollar behemoth. But what you also had along the way is a whole series of stocks that reached absolutely crazy valuations. So stock investors were saying, we think this particular stock is worth hundreds of multiples of the amount of money that the company is actually making. The prime example that people always bring up here is Pets.com. There was this cluster of stocks that were worth just well in excess of the money that they were actually making. And inevitably, that ran out of road and they all crashed all at once. And that left a really significant mark on US stock markets. It took years for people to, if they were, had invested at the top, it took years for people to come back to being whole. So we can kind of look back on it now and say, oh, look, well, you know, never mind. Amazon is now this huge monster and stock markets have recovered handily. That's very easy to say when it's all in the rearview mirror. If you were one of the people that bought at the top, which is one of the concerns that people like us have about the huge crowds of retail investors that are getting involved in AI stocks, that was a really difficult time.
So if you're in that position, you were only just recovering in time for the crash of 2008 and 2009, I imagine. Duncan?
The fascinating thing about the dot-com bubble analogy, though, is 25 years on, we can all see the internet was indeed a huge deal. The internet has transformed society, it's transformed business models, created all whole new industries, destroyed others. It was a huge, big technological change that mattered economically. But that doesn't mean there wasn't a bubble in the late 90s, early 2000s. You know, you can go further back. You look at railways in the 19th century. You know, the railway was a really, really important invention, changes the economic geography of the planet Earth. And yet there was a bubble in railway stocks. So, you know, some of the skepticism, talk of a bubble in AI stocks now. You don't have to think that AI is all junk to think there can be a bubble. There can be a bubble in a real technology.
Well, Simon, let's talk about how things are different or not now. Because AI is wrapped up with these huge tech companies, and because we think those tech companies, most of them will be around for a very long time, is it possible that we're missing another part of the picture, which is, yes, they will be, but will necessarily their investments in all the things they're investing in AI and the AI bits of them, will they be? Is there a distinction to be made there?
I think there is, and it's certainly the case. One of, I think, two arguments in the defence of the valuations we're seeing. First of all, the concentration amongst tech companies, pre-existing tech companies, which are hugely cash generative, have huge earnings pipelines on their cloud computing offering, their social network offering. There's a whole raft of other line items that, if we excuse the slightly political parlance of broad shoulders, these are companies that have broad shoulders should their CapEx, their capital expenditure, proved not to deliver the kind of returns that the market is starting to price. I said there were two cases for the defence. The other one, of course, is that perhaps in contrast to the dot-com bubble, this doesn't appear to be a US stock market valuation move that has spilled over into, for example, Europe and Japan. One of the things that's often forgotten is actually European tech in 1999-2000 went to extraordinary valuations as well. Actually, European stock markets, Japanese stock markets, certainly Chinese stock markets, UK stock markets certainly, is actually below its long-term average and potentially, therefore, a safe haven if those institutional investors that Katie was talking about hate the rally so much. Do they rotate back into asset classes that they've neglected for quite a period of time?
Well, Katie, that also raises another question, really, just the scale of the AI element of the stock market boom, which is, presumably, there are lots of other companies who are not doing quite so well, and the stock market boom might kind of disguise their situation. Yeah. Is that true?
That's absolutely true. One of the really important things to bear in mind here is that the main index that everyone talks about when they talk about US stocks is the S&P 500, and that is weighted according to the size of the companies inside it. Now, wrap your head around this number. Nvidia is worth, last time I checked, $4.4 trillion with a T dollars. That is a chunk of change. That, I believe I'm right in saying, is bigger than the entire FTSE 100, right?
So, I mean,
yeah, you can fit...
Which is our own pathetic little stock market.
Which is doing really well. And actually, if you're a UK investor and you've been investing in US stocks this year, you've been killed by a drop in the dollar and it hasn't done that well for you. That's a whole other issue. But yeah, one of the things that people really worry about in relation to the AI trade is we are talking about a tiny number of companies. You know, people talk about the Magnificent Seven tech stocks in the US. Seven, just seven. You know, there's 500 stocks, more or less, in the S&P 500. So there's a lot of companies that are having a stinker of a year. But the index is being held up on top of these broad shoulders, as Simon says, of companies like Apple, which is having a great run, Nvidia, which is just too big to even wrap your head around, that's in the chips industry. So it is very, very concentrated. And to me, that means you have quite a small number of potential points of failure, which worries me somewhat.
Simon.
Another interesting data point is the rally that we've seen in the US stock market. While a lot of the focus comes on those big cash generative Magnificent Seven stocks, the biggest rally, more than doubled in price since April, is amongst non-profitable technology companies, those that don't make any earnings at the moment. And that has uncomfortable parallels with the dot-com era, where that was really the those companies were the poster child of some of those ones that had what were very, very elevated valuations that triggered the bubble bursting.
Duncan, one of the things that I seem to remember is often said in these situations is that bad things happen essentially when the true economy is not actually reflected in the stock market. And so I suppose what I'm getting at is, which is the true economy in this situation? Is it the small number of tech companies who are doing really well, or is it the larger number of companies who may not be doing so well? And if it's the latter, to a significant extent, at what point may we see that bust coming?
Yeah, I mean, I think the US economy is really, really hard to read at the moment. There's all sorts of contradictory signals, and it's not helped by the fact there's a government shutdown and they are literally not publishing economic information at the moment. But, you know, the jobs market certainly has slowed sharply. What I find really interesting is when you look at, you know, the most recent forecasts from the International Monetary Fund or the OECD, all of these international organizations, they're all really, really keen to talk about how uncertain the outlook is. You don't see that uncertainty when you look at financial markets, which are just on a tear. They're sort of, you know, seizing on the good news, emphasizing the positives, seem, you know, oblivious to the risks sometimes.
So there's this gap growing. Simon, how much should we in the UK be worried about a potential hit to our pensions and investments should they turn out to have been a dot-com type bubble burst?
So Katie mentioned the impact of the US dollar devaluation this year, down about 10%. But actually, if you look at the holdings of UK pensions, about a £3 trillion asset class, we think it's about 55% of those assets are US dollar denominated assets, either US equity or US bonds. So the UK pensioner is far more geared actually to the US economy and the outcome of its US stock market than it is to its domestic UK market.
Simon, very quickly, is that a change from how it was before?
Absolutely. If you go back to 1990, UK pension funds had about 40% of their assets in the UK stock market. So there's been a big pivot. And by the way, that's been the right investment call because the US stock market has outperformed the UK stock market. I'm not suggesting it was the wrong investment call, but it does now open up the scenario where an economy like the US, with a stock market like the US, has fundamental impacts through a wealth effect, transmission through to the ability of UK households to spend from events almost entirely beyond our economic governance. And that is quite unusual, and I'm perhaps choosing my words carefully here, situation to be in. Some would say it's a bit of a strategic weakness for the UK economy, and that potential wealth effect is potentially highly significant for trying to track where the UK economy, the UK consumer, heads next.
Duncan, let's...
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Imagine, bust happens, stocks fall. What's the impact on us?
It's worth thinking about
economically.
It's worth thinking about transmission mechanisms from a financial, you know, fall in asset prices to what happens to the economy. And I think there are three that it's worth thinking about in this context. Firstly is what Simon was talking about, the wealth effect. The fact that if I think I have £10,000 worth of stocks and I check the market and they're now only worth £5,000, I feel a bit poorer and that might affect my day-to-day spending. Secondly, there's a big confidence impact on both firms and potentially consumers. If asset prices are falling, they may spend less, invest less. And I think in the case of artificial intelligence at the moment, there is an awful lot of investment, capital expenditure in all of these new data centers and all of the related infrastructure to power these models. If the value of the AI firms' shares fall, if they think this is going to be less profitable in the future, there's an awful lot of planned investment in real-world assets which could be cancelled very quickly.
What does that mean?
That's a slowing economy. It's worth saying the stock market can fall. The stock market can fall considerably without there being a recession. You know, end of 2021 to September 2022, the S&P 500 fell about 25%. And there wasn't a recession. You know, it's perfectly possible to imagine a stock market fall, which does not lead to a recession. But a stock market fall does make a recession more likely, I think it's fair to say.
Let's move on then to another aspect which might play into this a bit. When a bubble bursts, or to change the metaphor, a tide recedes, previously submerged problems tend to appear, don't they? Which brings me to this thing called private credit, or to put it in the scare quotes, shadow banking. And both Jamie Dimon and the Bank of England governor were warning about this. Duncan, what is this private credit thing?
Private credit, or, you know, shadow banking, or in the less dramatic language of US financial regulators, non-depository financial institutions. How much
easy for you to say.
Easy for me to say. You know, until about 15 years ago, if, say, a firm wanted a loan, there were two places it could borrow from. It could borrow from a bank, traditional bank loan, or it could borrow from sort of public bond markets by issuing a bond, which is basically a tradable loan. Straightforward and easy to understand. Over the last 15 or so years since the financial crisis in 2007, 8, 9, there is now this third option, this sort of shadow banking system. That's when, rather than borrowing from a traditional bank, which takes deposits, or rather than borrowing through a publicly traded bond, firms borrow from these private credit providers, these financial institutions which make loans, which don't fund themselves through taking deposits, but through raising money. And it really, really has boomed over the last 15 years. The IMF last year, in its financial stability review in April 2024, said the size of this market globally had grown from about $300 billion in 2007-08 to somewhere around $2.5 to $3 trillion in the 2020s.
So we are getting a lot of trillion dollars in here.
Yeah.
I'm suddenly wondering whether that's bigger or smaller than NVIDIA's. But anyway.
So it's in this huge sort of booming industry. Investors have made really good money out of it.
So Duncan, are the loans that these private credit institutions making more risky than the ones that conventional banks would make?
I mean, there are plenty of reasons to think these loans are more risky. They tend to be to smaller companies. They tend to be made quicker and with less hassle, which is great for the company borrowing, but means there's less checks and balances. You can ask yourself, why your company is choosing to borrow through private credit rather than, through more conventional means. And what we've seen, the reason people are really concerned at the moment is in the last few weeks, we've seen two sort of high-profile blow-ups in the United States of firms who have borrowed from these markets and, have now gone bust, aren't going to be able to pay back all of the loans. And now, people are worrying, is it just these two or is there something more systemic? Are we going to see a lot more loans going badly in this slightly murky part of the financial system?
You say murky. I mean, in what way is it actually murky? Firstly, who is giving them the money? Who's making these loans to them? I'm hoping at this point it's not my pension fund.
It may well be your pension fund, David. It's there are various sources.
Just mine.
Just yours. Earmarked, as I understand it, Mr. D. Aronovich, London. But so they're not. These loans are not directly coming from firms that take deposits like banks. They will generally be raising money from maybe a handful of high net worth individuals, but more generally from other large financial
institutions. High net worth individuals, i.e. very rich people.
Yes. So, but really we're talking pension funds, we're talking life insurance companies, we're talking sovereign wealth funds. And here's the wrinkle, perhaps some banks, because it looks like in the United States, some banks have been lending money to these non-depository financial institutions who then lend the money to companies.
At which point, I think the listener at home is just saying, do we learn nothing ever? Katie, since they have been there for a few years now, why is there a problem now?
Well, this is one of those things that's absolutely fine until it's not, right? And to be clear, the private credit industry has provided a lot of much needed money like quickly and easily without bucket loads of paperwork for companies that need it. It's much more prevalent in the States than it is over here.
Sorry, in a way that conventional banks wouldn't.
So if you're issuing a bond, like a proper bond, the type that Duncan refers to, it's like an IOU that you issue into markets that's bought by pension funds. They're a completely standard way of financing. If you do that, there is a wedge of paper that you can only just about grab in your hand of the paperwork that comes along with this. It's a huge pain in the bum. You've got to really want to do it to make it worth it. Whereas private lenders will come along and say, look, you don't need to do all that. Look, maybe it'll cost you a bit more, but it's a lot less of a pain and we can be a lot more flexible. So if you as a company get yourself into hot water, don't worry, we can extend the loan. Don't worry, we can restructure it somehow so that you can get through this period. So this has helped a lot of risky companies to get money that they might otherwise not have been able to get their hands on. And that is all fine until the point at which companies start getting into trouble, which is not too difficult to imagine in the case of companies in the States where you have got a big immigration crackdown, where you have cracks in the labour market. It's quite easy to imagine companies getting into trouble. And at a certain point, you can't extend and pretend these loans any longer.
So let's be clear. These are the companies that these private credit institutions have lent to.
Yes.
Which means that they may have some difficulty paying back the people that they have borrowed from.
When you talk to big institutional investors now, they say, look, we've had a couple of failures here. We've had this auto parts maker in the States called First Brands, and we have another autos retailer called Tricolor. And These are probably isolated examples of quite big companies that have got themselves in trouble using money that they've borrowed from private lenders. These are probably idiosyncratic events. But those of us who were around in 2007 and have got the grey hair to prove it know that at that point, there were all these things called, it's subprime mortgage lenders. And they just seemed to be individually getting into trouble here, there and everywhere. And we all wrote it all off as, well, this is a one-off. Well, this is a special situation. And at a certain point in sort of 07 and the early part of 08, we all sort of looked around the room and were like, lads, there's something going on here. I don't like the look of this. And so, look, this isn't that necessarily in this instance, but this is exactly what Andrew Bailey was talking about at the Bank of England yesterday. He was saying, those of us who remember that period know that when you see one or two problems, that can, not necessarily will be, but can be an early sign of a more systemic problem here.
Simon, what do you think?
So financial regulation is like squeezing a balloon. And what has very clearly happened after the global financial crisis is the bank sector, and distinct from this, the non-bank sector, has had to, because of the regulation being systemically important financial institutions, or SIFIs, have had to raise their capital from about 2%. Their loan book to about 12, 13, 14%, depending on which country and which institution. And as a result, they've had to, as part of that journey, shrink their credit book. And that has moved, this is the squeezing the balloon analogy, moved the credit, so you don't have to fill in that wedge of paper that Katie was talking about, to other parts of the economy. What worries me that is the idea of regulators like Andrew Bailey, you know, drawing parallels. But unfortunately, the challenge for a regulator is to recognise that you haven't taken that behaviour away, you've just shifted it to other parts of the financial ecosystem. And is your regulatory perimeter moving with it, or are you just elegantly describing the problem over there?
Okay, Duncan, what's the answer to that question? What have they done? I mean, presumably, yep, if he's warning about it, it's a sign that he hasn't moved, we haven't moved the regulation properly into this area and that we are at risk.
There is a difference between banks and non-banks. You know, when banks get into problems like they did in 2008, 2009, big, serious banks, this isn't just about investors losing money. You start to worry, does the payment system survive? You know, there were days in 2008, 2009 when, you know, there was a real risk that employers were going to make a payroll payment and their employees weren't going to get paid, when people were going to go to cash machines and no money was going to come out. So you do want your systemically important big banks to be safer. And touch wood, they are safer now. Yeah. But that doesn't mean, you know, but this lending, risky lending is still happening, potentially risky lending is still happening somewhere else in the system. If that goes bad, then an awful lot of people could lose an awful lot of money. There can be problems for the economy as bank lending slows, but hopefully you're not in those 2008, 2009, is the cash machine going to still work moments.
Well, this is very interesting. It brings us on to, if you like, a kind of third element, because you could argue that the 2008-9 crash happened against a better overall global background than anything happening now would do. And one of the elements that a lot of people feel that composes that bad background, Katie, are the Trump tariffs. Can you just remind us what the immediate reaction was of the financial world when Trump did his Liberation Day announcements?
Well, he kind of opened up the gates of hell in financial markets. There he was standing in the Rose Garden with his kind of flip chart type things, telling everyone what the tax is going to be on imports from all different countries around the world. And they were much, much, much higher than anyone had been expecting. And they were quite scattergun too. You know, there was the famous example of an island entirely inhabited by penguins that had a tariff imposed on it. And so this did a couple of things. First of all, it made the administration look quite silly, which is just not great in terms of the credibility of the world's most important market, most important institutions. But secondly, the thought among investors was, how on earth are companies in the US going to swallow these tariffs? Who's going to pay for this? This has to be bad for the US economy. Turned out to be not so bad, but it has to be bad for companies. They're going to have to eat these taxes. So the stock market cratered and in the US, and because the US is so much bigger than all the other stock markets around the world, that just dragged everybody down with it. It's just that force of gravity. So that was one thing, and that kind of makes instinctive sense, and to an extent, it's kind of fine. That's what stock markets are for. They're there to value companies. The bit that got really scary was that the dollar fell off a cliff, but also that US government bonds fell sharply in price. Now, normally, when bad stuff happens, tariffing penguins, famine, pandemic, whatever it is, these things jump in value. They're a good place for investors to hide when bad stuff happens. In this instance, they didn't. So it was a combination of investors saying, this is going to really hurt companies, but also this really hurts US institutions. This is a bad geopolitical moment that really created this kind of firestorm. And it was particularly when the bond market started creaking, and it really creaked, and I got pretty worried for a while that that thing was going to break. That was the point at which Trump blinked. And so this is why we have this thing, this phrase coined by my colleague Rob Armstrong, the taco trade, right? Trump always chickens out. This got Rob in huge amounts of trouble and was all very entertaining for a while. But, you know, there is a point of pain for Trump when markets really fall out of bed. And that came with the drop in US government bond prices. And he said, oh, OK, well, we're going to institute a pause. Since then, we've had this ridiculous back and forth of pausing, not pausing, ratcheting up on one country, cutting the rates on another. He's decided to levy a very high tariff against Switzerland, of all countries. Like, who's annoyed with Switzerland? Like, why Switzerland? Brazil has come in for harsh treatment.
But for political reasons, entirely for political
reasons. So this is it, right? It's very much around his personal preferences. And so we've got to a point where tariffs are globally much lower. Maybe there's an effective rate globally of, Duncan, what do you reckon, 10, 12%? It's something in that order. Corporate America is kind of eating this. The economy is kind of eating it, and it's been sort of okay, but it's not over. So what we saw just a few days ago is that China said it was going to put export controls on its rare earths. China has been very canny and made big stockpiles of metals that are very difficult to get out of the ground, that are very useful for AI and defense and all sorts of other things. They said, right, two can play at this game, sunshine, with your export controls. We're going to put export controls on our rare earths. And Trump said, bosh, have another 100% on your tariff. And people are just like head in hands, like, what the hell is this? Now, over the course of the weekend, guess what? Trump always chickens out. Taco trade was back. He's decided that he wants to be friends with China again. I just don't even know what the situation is at the moment. But it's a reminder that we all think that Trump's tariffs are kind of, they've reached a steady state and they're kind of dead and buried. No. He could get into an argument with any country at any time and jack them up.
So, Duncan, I think this brings us to the question about the real economic impact of the Trump tariffs, both in the United States, where it was expected to have an inflationary effect because prices would have to go up, and also on the rest of the world, really, because we were going to have more of our stuff tariffed by the US.
Yeah, so I think, you know, if you go back to April and the immediate aftermath of Liberation Day, the assumption was that the average US tariff rate was going to be about 25%, a tax of 25% on the average good coming into the United States. You know, where we are now in October, the average rate being charged is more like 10%. So we are a lot lower than it looked like it was going to be in April. And I don't think we've even seen the full impact of that 10% yet, because it takes a long time for contracts to adjust, for firms to decide on their pricing strategy. So, you know, there's still an awful lot more pain to come, I think, on the inflationary side. But it is worth saying, you know, some very good work done by some economists at Harvard Business School, looking at the price of imported and domestic goods. And you see the trend change once the tariffs are in place, that it looked like you had gradually inflation gradually coming down, now gradually going up instead. So I think we're not at the end point, but we're feeling some pain.
Katie.
Yeah, one really important point here has been that one of the things that's helping to support the US stock market is this widespread assumption that the US central bank, the Federal Reserve, is going to be cutting interest rates. And look, most likely it is going to be cutting interest rates, especially if Trump gets his way, right? He wants people who are in control of monetary policy, of interest rates, who are very much supportive of low borrowing costs. But the potential curveball is inflation. You know, we haven't seen the full force of inflation come through as a result of tariffs. Maybe we are all thinking about how tariffs work wrongly. Maybe we don't quite understand the economic impact. Or maybe this just hasn't hit yet. You can see some signs in consumer goods of prices starting to go up. As Duncan says, we're in a bit of a data black hole. We're not getting very much official economic data out of the States at the moment because the government is shut down. But if we get to a point where inflation does bite later this year or early next year, if that stops the Federal Reserve from being able to cut interest rates in the way that we're all expecting, that could go badly.
Katie, there's something I don't understand in this. If you put prices up, people have to pay more, or someone has to pay more, and usually people have to pay more, and that causes inflation. Now, true, the US government gets more revenue, but that doesn't decrease inflation by itself, does it? So I just don't understand how this isn't just inflationary.
The revenue that has been coming through from tariffs is actually quite helpful for US public finances, ironically. But yet there is a lot of kind of confusion over who pays the tariffs. Now, if you listen to Trump and if you listen to some of the senior officials that are around him, they will tell you with a straight face, China pays the tariffs, Mexico pays the tariffs. Just this is simply not true. But we've all just wasted too much breath on saying this over the past sort of 6 months or so. US importers pay the tariffs. Now, the sort of issue around how quickly that becomes inflationary depends on the extent to which companies say, OK, this stuff that I'm importing from China is now costing me, say, 18% more. Am I as a company just going to wear that and keep my prices the same for US consumers? Or am I going to pass on that cost when it's, you know, the actual sticker with the price on it on the front of my goods on the shelves? Now, to a large extent, so far, US companies, which have been, you know, doing great for a number of reasons, they have swallowed a lot of the cost. But at a certain point, you just can't help but wonder where their pain point is and whether that might just start trickling through to consumers.
Well, I'm just wondering about those companies that sit on the stock market somewhere long way down below the tech companies who are looking at their profit margins being squeezed and whether people want to buy shares in them.
Absolutely. And that's why you've got this weirdly top-heavy market in the States where the big AI giants are doing fantastically, and a lot of smaller companies really are not. You know, if you look outside of the S&P 500 index, which is the kind of benchmark index for US stocks, if you look at the Russell 2000, which is of smaller companies, not such a great picture. So corporate America is nowhere near as healthy as the S&P 500 would suggest.
Right. And Katie, one other thing, which is about the future. I mean, we're talking as if, almost as if, we're in the settled state of the Trump tariffs, although you have warned us not to think like that. Is there any kind of view that there's a risk that Trump feels so emboldened by the fact that his tariffs haven't caused the collapse that some people have predicted that he'll just think, well, you know, I'm really successful in this, so let's do a bit more of it?
100%. One of the big things that investors said before Trump came back into office was, don't worry, he won't do anything too stupid because that would hit the stock market and that would hit bonds and it would hit the dollar. And he doesn't want that. He's a stock market guy. Turns out that stock investors have a much higher pain threshold than we thought. That they're willing to look, you know, just disregard a lot of horrible stuff that's going on and just keep on buying US stocks. And that absolutely emboldens the president to push further and further and further. To me, that means that the higher they come, the further they fall, and that we are sort of potentially building up to something that could be quite nasty. Not necessarily, but potentially. But the fact that investors have been so generous to the president absolutely emboldens him to push it further.
Duncan, I think we're going to have to begin to draw this to a conclusion. Does this feel to you, particularly with the AI, that what we're looking at is a kind of possible sharp adjustment? In other words, it's going to be painful but manageable. Or if we take it together with the other things like the private credit risk and what's happening in the world economy, there could be something bigger.
There always could be something bigger. I think at the moment there are all of the characteristics of a bubble, particularly in AI stocks. But just because I'm saying it's a bubble now doesn't mean it can't keep inflating for quite some time to come. But I do think, you know, the base case has to be at some point in the coming months, something causes that bubble to pop. We see a big downward adjustment in asset prices, and that has a serious knock-on impact on real economic growth. I'm not saying 2007, 2008, 2009, or even, you know, 2020 and 2021, the pandemic. Those were genuinely, you know, systemic big shocks. But, you know, your common or garden recession certainly feels possible.
Katie.
I think a correction definitely could happen. So maybe we shed sort of, you know, 10% off the top of the US stock market. That'll be horrible. It'll be painful, but it wouldn't be the end of the world. And it might actually reset markets into something a little bit more sane than what we're living in right now.
But not 2008-9?
I don't think so. Famous last words, but I really don't think so. Right, I think the system is safer than it was back then. It has, you know, as Simon was saying, banks are much safer. Levels of corporate debt are much more modest. Household debt is much more modest. So it shouldn't be a total train wreck, but it might be ugly.
Simon, escape pad in New Zealand and a flight out next week, or steady as you go?
So listeners should never think that any of us, however senior we are, you know, Jamie Dimon, Andrew Bailey, Jerome Powell, none of us really know how to time the market. The best investors of all time acknowledge that. The greatest economist of all time, John Maynard Keynes, said the market can remain irrational longer than I can remain solvent. And that is an important message to remember. The point I would make is you try and calibrate. You calibrate, are there more risky signals out there or less risky signals? And you calibrate how much risk you would take accordingly. I would say on the balance, there are more risky signals than I've seen for quite a long time in the stock market. So I'd be more cautious in that environment. The thing that worries me as an economist is, have we built in the 15, 16 years since the global financial crisis, and arguably in the 25 years since the dot-com bubble burst, an economy, going back to Duncan's point, that is more susceptible should the stock market crash on it impacting real things like jobs, like consumer spending. That's what worries me about what I'm seeing at the moment.
That's it. My thanks to Duncan Weldon, Katie Martin and Simon French. And we'll be back at the same time next week, hopefully. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Nathan Gower and Kirstine Knight. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundeli. The sound engineer was Duncan Hannant. And the editor was Richard Varden. And another edition of this podcast will be along again very soon.
Hello, Greg Jenner here, host of You're Dead to Me. In my new family-friendly podcast series, Dead Funny History, historical figures come back to life for just about long enough to argue with me, tell us their life stories, and sometimes get on my nerves. There's 15 lovely episodes to unwrap, including the life of Ramses the Great, Josephine Baker, and the history of football, plus much, much more. So this Christmas, give your ears a treat with Dead Funny History. You can find it in the You're Dead to Me feed on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.